dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has lived and served in that war in a variety of very interesting capacities is our guest for this full hour. His name is Grant Newsham. I should say Colonel Grant Newsham, United States Marine Corps retired. He has gone on from the Marines to do a number of interesting things that are directly relevant to our topic today, which is going to be China, and specifically the Chinese Communist Party and what it is up to. He has served as an executive director of Morgan Stanley Japan, as the secretary manager of Motorola Japan, as a foreign service officer, and these days he is a senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies. He is also a lawyer by training, JD from UCLA. He is graciously giving of his time from a great remove. I'm afraid it's probably pretty late at night where you are, but Grant Newsham, thank you very much for giving us your time in Taiwan, and welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Sure. Thanks very much. I always appreciate it.
Well, I'm going to start with Hong Kong. You're sort of in the general vicinity over there. There were to be more demonstrations this past weekend. I'm unclear as to whether they materialized or in any way, shape, or form replicated the extraordinary number of people who were in the streets the weekend before, some 2 million of them. But Grant, give us a flavor of what you see happening there. Why are people demonstrating? And what do you think the likely response, at least over time, by the Chinese is going to be to those demonstrations?
Well, I think what you're seeing is some very deep-seated and widespread unhappiness with the gradual erosion of the freedoms, the liberties, particularly the ability to speak and say what you feel like. And to be free of sort of arbitrary government harassment and government arrest and disappearance, the erosion of the freedoms that people in Hong Kong got used to. And admittedly, there's 7 million people in Hong Kong, and there's not everyone thinks alike, but to get such a huge percentage of the population out on the street, young people, old people from all walks of life, to get them out on the street protesting against this, what is the erosion of individual freedom, liberty, is really saying something.
All the more so, Grant, because one of the things that's a hallmark of the Chinese communist system, as you know, is this unbelievable surveillance state. And I believe that it's operating in Hong Kong as well as on the mainland, certainly with limitless numbers of security cameras and the facial recognition, walk recognition, and other techniques that are now used to give very, well, real time, I believe, insights into who's out there in the streets, setting them up for punishment if the regime in Beijing decides to do so. Is that right?
That's certainly what I hear. And beyond the sort of the electronic surveillance, you also have, and this has been going on a long time, really a gradual subversion of the Chinese police force, where PRC mainland officers, intelligence officials, they're posted throughout Hong Kong, and the police force, I think you would fairly say, is definitely tainted. And that's been going on for at least a decade.
I'm told that there are even indications that you have Chinese People's Liberation Army personnel simply dressed up as these Hong Kong police. Is there evidence of that too?
You know, I've seen reports of it. I haven't seen what I would consider conclusive evidence, but then again, I'm not there.
Sounds right, doesn't it? If they're sending in all those other characters, you can bet they would. So when you see the people of Hong Kong, whatever it is, a third of them practically, in the streets of Hong Kong demonstrating against this inexorable, as you put it, erosion of their rights, obviously that's a very serious threat to the Chinese Communist Party on the mainland, that there could possibly be such resistance and such opposition to the diktat of Beijing, which was specifically triggered by this effort to jam through a statute that would give them carte blanche. I mean, they do it when they want to, but carte blanche to extradite anybody for whatever reason, basically, from Hong Kong back to the mainland, where, as you say, they may be at best tried for some crime or worse, simply disappeared. This has prompted the kind of resistance that we've been talking about. How is China, how is the Communist Chinese Party responding at the moment? And to what extent do you think, Grant, that it has something to do with the imminent meeting of President Trump with his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping?
I think the Chinese Communist Party leadership is back-footed. I think they don't quite know what to do because the protests in Hong Kong, it really gives a lie to their entire narrative that Chinese people don't mind being dealt with a boot on the neck. This notion that all is harmony under the Chinese Communist Party's unfailingly wise leadership. And here you have these people who have gone out in the face of real danger, far more than any protesters you'll see against Mr. Trump in the United States. And whenever you get this group of people who are out specifically protesting the Chinese Communist Party's leadership's ideas, their government. And there's really no easy way around that. So it gives a lie to the narrative that you hear out of Beijing. What do you do about it? You can either, one, use force, you can play for time. What I think is going to happen is that the sort of people who they can identify as the leaders of this protest are going to gradually start disappearing, come under all sorts of pressure. And I think they'll try to go about it that way. But, you know, trying to extinguish sort of the spark of sort of human freedom, Joseph Stalin couldn't even do it. So I'm not convinced the men in Zhongnanhai can do it as well.
Yeah. We'll be hopefully watching this closely. I know that the government of the United States has expressed some concern about what's being done. And I do think that Xi may behave rather differently after the summit meeting with the president. It would be, shall we say, chilling on what may already be a pretty difficult meeting to have a sort of Tiananmen 2-style crackdown in Hong Kong in the run-up to their sit-down on the margins of the G20 meeting in Japan this coming week. Grant, we have to pause for just a second. When we come back, I want to ask you to pivot with me to the country in which you are currently standing, Taiwan, and what's next for it right after this with Grant Newsham.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Grant Newsham. He is a senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies. He brings to his work there some extraordinary credentials and background as a foreign service officer, before that as a colonel in the United States Marine Corps, as well as an executive in Motorola and Morgan Stanley Japan. Grant, again, thank you for your time. We were visiting a moment ago about Hong Kong and what is happening there at the moment and what may yet happen. I'm sure there's very considerable interest in the country in which you are currently in place, namely Taiwan, about what China is up to and whether whatever it has in mind for Hong Kong is pretty much a foretaste of what it will seek to accomplish with respect to Taiwan and its sovereignty and independence, which has been an infuriating thorn in the side of the Chinese Communist Party for decades. Give us a flavor of the relationship at the moment between Hong Kong and what's happening to it and what you think might be in store for Taiwan.
Well, Frank, I think, as you said, people in Taiwan can see what's happening in Hong Kong, and they know that that's what they can expect in the event that Taiwan is taken over or it is subverted to the point that it agrees to sort of be taken over by Chinese Communist China. And that does cause a lot of concern, and you really see it in the younger generations in particular, who really have no experience, no memory of the how things used to be, of the Chinese Civil War. But rather, they've grown up in what is effectively an independent country where they've got freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and freedom of everything. They choose their leaders. And this is there is a sense that, you know, wow, we don't want what we're seeing in Hong Kong. And that, so not surprisingly, the Chinese Communist Party's ham-handed behavior in Hong Kong is, if anything, is driving Taiwan even further away than it already was. But Taiwan is, of course, under considerable pressure from the mainland, particularly political subversion, propaganda, constant hectoring and threats of violence if they don't come back to China. And this is it's a very difficult situation, and not to say the least, the sort of psychologically, the population here feels a bit beaten down and does wonder if how much support it actually has from America in particular.
Well, this is the multi-billion-dollar question, of course, and I think many of us in this country have been mulling it as well and heartened by some of the things that the Trump administration has done to establish that it's committed to the security of Taiwan, for example, with respect to some arms sales that are at some stage of processing for improving dramatically the increasingly obsolete, not just obsolescent, obsolete military equipment the Taiwanese are relying upon to deter the Chinese. And at the same time, and as a military man, I'd ask you to sort of, explore this with us, Grant, the Chinese buildup of amphibious and ballistic missile and air defense and other capabilities for projecting power, should they choose to do so in Taiwan, has been growing quite dramatically in recent years. So the need for improvements on the Taiwanese side are all the greater. How would you characterize, how do you think the people of Taiwan would characterize their relationship with us under Donald Trump?
Well, I think under President Trump, there's a sort of a sense that Taiwan has more support than it's ever had. There is, of course, some desire to see the concrete results of that. But at least psychologically, there's a sense that this administration actually does give two hoots about Taiwan rather than wishing it would just go quietly into the loving arms of the People's Republic of China. But as you stated, the military imbalance is just that. It's an imbalance now, and the Chinese have built up a considerable force that is a huge threat to Taiwan. Taiwan does have some advantages of playing defense, and the geography works in its favor as well. But it doesn't. What's really killing it or hurting it a lot is this isolation. The Taiwan military for 40 years has not really been able to interact with any foreign militaries. And so think of it like a baseball team that never gets to play a game against anybody. You don't improve the way you should. And also you do wonder, well, these people say we're our friends, they're our friends, but they don't let us actually do anything with them. You come and give advice, but, you know, advice is cheap. How about letting us come out and actually do some exercises, do some training? this is the key thing that this administration needs to address, I think, is that military isolation of Taiwan. And it also needs to address the economy. I think that is equally important. The economy here is a little slow. And one thing the administration could do is at least hold out the strong promise of a free trade agreement. So address those two things, and that would go a long way towards convincing sort of the Taiwan public writ large that America will indeed support it.
Mm-hmm. When you hear Americans talking about their commitment or providing, as you say, cheap advice, does that ring hollow with the people of Taiwan in the absence of the kinds of things you're talking about, the exercises and the arms sales for that matter, to the point where it's feeding into the domestic tendency, at least for quite a number of Taiwanese, to say, well, let's just, you know, make a separate peace with China? And we've had presidential candidates in the past, indeed presidents of Taiwan, operate on that basis, haven't we? Not the president, the incumbent, President Tsai, but some of her predecessors have for sure. And some of the candidates who are running against her, I gather, for this current or coming election.
That's correct. There are some candidates that are considered to be sort of more amenable to the idea of reaching an agreement with the mainland, which would surrender Taiwan's de facto status and even independence. And that is what Chinese subversion is working to achieve. Madam Tsai, of course, is quite the opposite. She's a very impressive leader. But the Americans, the standoffishness, and I would suggest really a desire not to defend Taiwan in some parts of the State Department, even in DOD, I think that it's not as if nobody here hasn't recognized that. And that there's a psychological aspect to all of this. If people believe the Americans are firmly committed, then they're more likely to defend themselves. If they think they're sort of on their own, that's a very tough thing to deal with. And I would note that in as much as one can characterize what an entire population thinks, so the vast majority do not want to be a part of the People's Republic of China. The way that subversion works is you don't need a majority, you just need some of the right people in the right places. And that is, I think, a real concern here. It's up to the Americans in many respects, and we will see what they do. I would note at this point, yes, Taiwan is important strategic geography. It's right in the middle of the so-called first island chain. And also at stake is an implicit American guarantee to protect Taiwan. But more than anything, I think Taiwan has become an idea. And it's an idea that people can live freely. They can have consensual government and all the freedoms that we like. And these people just happen to be Chinese. And that is what is at stake here, is the idea of much higher manifestation of human freedom than you'll find almost anywhere, or certainly anywhere on the mainland by a mile, and in most other parts of the world as well. And that is something that I think we do need to remember.
Well, and this is, again, as we were just saying about Hong Kong, Graham Newsham, such a threat to the Chinese Communist Party. And one of the reasons why it seems to me so likely that if the United States is not more credibly demonstrating its commitment to that free and sovereign Taiwan, both by, you know, its exercises and its presence there and its arms sales and through every other political and, for that matter, economic device, we will see the Chinese at some point, and possibly in the not too distant future, snuffing Taiwan, just as I fear they intend to do with the autonomy of Hong Kong. These are all the more reasons why I think the kind of admonitions that you're offering are so needed. And there's a report that the Madam Tsai, as you call her, the president of Taiwan, will be coming to New York in the not too distant future. I'm not quite sure for what purpose, but I very much hope that our government will seize that opportunity to meet with her and demonstrate at the highest levels the commitment that we do have for Taiwan. And as you said, Graham, for the qualities that make it really both a thorn in the side of the China mainland political party there, the communists, but also such an inspiration, I think, to millions and millions and millions of Chinese and certainly a great many others in the region besides. Not least, of course, is the very dire implication were we to abandon them to the not-so-tender mercies of communist China. What that would mean for the people of Taiwan, obviously, is terrible, but what it would mean for both people elsewhere in the region, their inclination to engage in separate pieces, and of course, their diminished confidence in us would be unmistakable, I fear. Brent Newsham, we will come back for more when we return. I'm anxious to pick your brains about the trade deal that the president is being encouraged to sign with China right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're visiting with the Senior Research Fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies, Grant Newsham, about his insights into what is developing in the Western Pacific and what it will mean for all of us. He has a lot of insights, as it happens, based on his time as a colonel in the United States Marine Corps, now retired in finance, based in Japan, as well as managing Motorola Japan, also his service as a foreign service officer, a man of extraordinary capabilities, and we're delighted to have a chance to pick his brains at length today. Hey, Grant, we were talking about Taiwan and Hong Kong before that. Let me pivot to the trade deal that the president is being importuned to strike with the Chinese. We had Gordon Chang on the show yesterday, and he was quite confident, I think it's fair to say, that the Chinese preconditions are now so unacceptable to President Trump that this meeting between the two men in Japan at the G20 will not bear fruit, that it will, if anything, be a very difficult conversation. Tell us what you are making of the negotiations and their prospects at the G20, but also the advisability of us sort of going down the road, if we might, of striking a deal that would leave unaddressed a myriad other issues, including many in the national security space, that we find ourselves at odds with the Chinese on.
Sure. I don't think there's going to be an agreement reached at the G20 or anytime soon, actually. My sense is that the PRC, the Chinese Communist Party leadership, intends to wait out Donald Trump in hopes that they get a new administration in 2020. I don't think you will see any concessions on their part. Plus, any concessions they might make it's almost impossible to conceive of them because it would require such a change in behavior, really away from a predatory sort of approach to dealing with trade partners to one which is sort of like the Canadians. It's just too hard to imagine. You know, I was never very optimistic in the first place. If some sort of deal is reached where the Chinese agree to buy a certain amount more of our products, and that is declared to be a victory, it's nothing of the sort. But hopefully the administration won't go for that. But I would suggest that ultimately it's in the United States' interest to keep up the sort of the current approach and really try to wean American businesses off their pathologic dependence on the Chinese market. You're in a market where the government there wants to destroy you, wants to take over your business and replace you with Chinese companies. And that's been played out over the years now.
Well, I noted that you had previously worked for Motorola. And as it happens, Grant, I was in Chicago over the weekend for the most recent of these wonderful Committee on the Present Danger China events that we've been holding both in Washington and New York Dallas and now Chicago. Hopefully we'll do so elsewhere around the country to raise awareness about what the Chinese are up to. And boy, was it ever on display, what you've just described in terms of the takedown of America's manufacturing base, specifically the electronics industry, as a deliberate, well, one of our members, Shali Kumar, called the premeditated murder of that industrial sector in this country. Motorola was one of the most significant of the players in that industry at a time and was now no more. And I don't need to tell you how that came about, but perhaps you could tell our listeners.
Motorola, which if you're old enough and remember it, it was one of the top American companies, absolutely iconic. It after the Tiananmen Square massacres in 1989, Motorola actually was the first major foreign company to come back into China, and it thought it was friends with the Chinese Communist Party. I thought it was doing them a favor. And the idea was Motorola would come in, set up operations, and it would give Chinese people these nice jobs, and they would become wealthier, and they'd buy more Motorola products. What Motorola did, however, was come in and set up and basically create its own competition, and that eventually was making pretty much the same stuff at pretty much about as well and for lower prices. And Motorola ultimately, it kind of doesn't exist very much anymore, and Chinese companies took over what is, or a good chunk of it. Motorola, it was done through, this was just pure stupidity and naivety, and they went in, and this one of America's best companies really doesn't exist anymore. And they, as I say, they created their competition, and they got eaten alive.
Yeah, we saw repeated sort of manifestations of that same practice in the persons of I think there were 8 different, or maybe 9 different Indian American entrepreneurs who had been active in this particular part of the economy, all of whom had similar stories to tell of the Chinese simply coming in and deliberately seeking to run them out of business, steal their proprietary information, or otherwise take them out, and to varying degrees succeeded. This is the sort of thing that I think is needed to inform our understanding of what China is about more generally, the kind of unrestricted warfare, as they call it, that they've been waging against us for, well, decades, it seems. And as you look at this, I wonder if I might draw you out as well on some of the other manifestations of that warfare, Grant Newsham. I'm thinking in particular of the build-out of the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, a kind of imperial effort to put in place both traditional and digital kinds of infrastructure that will enable the Chinese to project power and dominate key areas of the world, choke points, particularly at sea. And in that regard, could we talk a little bit about what they've been doing on the Horn of Africa in Djibouti?
Yes, in Djibouti, basically the Chinese have set up a military base after saying they were not going to do that. They really have now got a base with Marines, armored vehicles, aircraft, and it's there. And beyond that, they have subverted the local government, got them to actually cancel improperly the port management agreement, I think with Dubai Port Worlds, and just sort of canceled it. And now a Chinese company runs the commercial port, as I understand it. Keep in mind, this has all happened after years of denials. But here you have it, a military presence. The more an equally interesting thing to watch, though, is Chinese involvement in farther out in the Horn of Africa, in Oman, Eritrea, and Ethiopia. And look at a map and look where these facilities are that the Chinese have access to, and then even get beyond that, just worldwide. And in some ways, one has to have some grudging respect for what they've been able to accomplish under the cover of just an economic development scheme.
Well, grudging respect leavened by a considerable degree of apprehension, I think it's fair to say, because it's ominous indeed. And in particular, I'd ask you, Camp Lemonnier is an American base that's pretty much cheek by jowl with the one that the Chinese are now operating. And it seems as though increasingly the Chinese are beginning to interfere with our operations there. They're lasing pilots, they're flying drones to interfere with our aircraft's operations, and apparently actually sent some guys over the fence recently. What do you know about that? And what does that speak of beyond the lies, beyond the, you know, insertion and subversion that you've referred to so far?
Well, what you've described is indeed what has happened. Chinese are terrible neighbors almost anywhere they go. And you're seeing that on display in Djibouti at Camp Lemonnier. The lasing and then just the brazen denials is just outrageous. But even worse is the United States' failure to really make something of it.
Well, we call it unprofessional.
Oh, boy, that scares them. Yeah, this sort of thing really has been going on for so long that one does think that if the Japanese and the Germans had waited a little longer, they'd have probably won the wars, given the ruling class. That's a little unfair.
This is a pretty powerful indictment. Let me just ask you about one thing, though, but that makes me even crazier, and that is the implications of having the Chinese invited to bring their naval forces into the Persian Gulf to assure safe passage of their vessels or oil tankers that are headed to them, for example. I understand the idea that President Trump is sort of advancing here, that, you know, everybody ought to do their fair share. But the Horn of Africa is a place where we saw this translating into when they were invited to send in anti-piracy, you know, forces, helping the Chinese justify and facilitate even their buildup of their naval presence in those waters, no?
That's right. Once you invite the Chinese in, you invite them into an exercise, it doesn't matter what it is, that they will try to dominate, try to take it over, push their weight around. Very pushy. And anyone who's dealt with them, say in the anti-piracy patrol, says the same thing. The exercises, say RIMPAC exercise, you invite them in and they demand top billing, an equal role in.
And collect intelligence throughout, no?
And that's part of it. I remember some years ago, a young Marine officer, he told me this was when the Chinese were invited into the anti-piracy work off the Horn of Africa. And he said, this is great. We're going to teach them military operations, how to get better and better, and then we're going to have to fight them someday.
There you go. I'm afraid this is where we are at the moment, for sure. Grant, we have to pause for one more moment. We'll be right back with our final segment with Grant Newsham right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for the fourth and final installment of this really extraordinary conversation with a man who has studied closely, worked in, served in the Western Pacific Theater, and understands it probably as well as just about anybody in or out of uniform. He did wear the uniform of the United States Marine Corps, rising to the rank of colonel. He is also a foreign service officer in the past and a man who served in industry in Japan, notably Motorola and Morgan Stanley. He is, of course, Grant Newsham, and we're very grateful for his time. Grant, we've covered a lot of ground, identified a lot of problems, and a lot of reasons to be quite concerned that they might be quite inimical to our interests. Let's conclude this conversation by talking a bit about what we can do about all this, and specifically, what, as you see it, can we realistically expect, given, you know, the distances involved, our own force limitations, to see from our allies. But let's start with what our strategy should be and what our capabilities are now and must be transformed into.
That's a good question. Have we got another hour to go over it? But
not this day, but another day, perhaps.
Well, here's a few things that it's important to pay attention to. The first thing is the U.S.-Japan relationship. I think that is really what underpins stability in the Asia region. Particularly the U.S.-Japan defense relationship, that really augments our combat capabilities there. But it's worth noting that the Japanese haven't done as much as they should to build up their militaries, particularly to spend for it. And that does need some attention. There's been over the years, we've rotely declared it the most important bilateral relationship, bar none, never been stronger. And yet the Japanese military needs to really improve itself and better link with us. The two navies do a fine job and show what's capable. But that's really the key to everything, is the U.S.-Japan relationship. It's the defense relationship in particular, but out of that flows the political relationship, or vice versa, take your pick. Additionally, we have other allies and friends in the region. In Australia, should not overlook them. You know, at the end of the day, they've probably the best ally we've ever had anywhere. Work with Australia. And then there's an idea of showing your commitment. And you do that by, one, being there, being in a lot of places a lot of the time. And don't get distracted in the Middle East the way that we tend to do, but really pay attention to the region. And I would note that Taiwan deserves particular attention. And it really is, I think, if that were somehow to be lost or come under Chinese communist domination, that it would be the equivalent of the walls of Constantinople being breached in 1453. It would make it very difficult to maintain our position in Asia. Additionally, part of all of this, beyond the military, there's a sort of a propaganda angle, and I mean that in the good original meaning, as the Jesuits used to use it, which is really explaining yourself, explaining what America is about, what the free countries are about, what they have at stake in the region, what they're trying to do. That the U.S., unfortunately, is horrible at that and has been at least since USIA was folded into the State Department in about 1999 or so.
A terrible mistake.
Really, it undercuts everything else you do if you can't explain it.
Well, worse, as you probably know, what the Voice of America and such other entities as we continue to operate in that space with, you know, government subsidies or oversight is as often as not Chinese propaganda as it is in the worst sense of the word, as it is ours in the good. Let me ask you about India, because this is another country that isn't technically in the Pacific, of course, but it's certainly a player in that part of the world. The Chinese have long regarded it and treated it with hostility. They have also, I think it's fair to say, seized their territory. Somebody described to me that the size of the territory that was actually wrested from India by China earlier on was about half the size of the United States. I don't know if that's quite right or not, but it's got my attention. And when you look at the capabilities of the Indians and like those of the Japanese, are they measuring up? Are they doing enough? And can we, in fact, rely upon them, as you see it, Grant Nishin?
Well, I think the Indians have their limitations. Everybody does. I think part of the problem is that their Ministry of Defense, because the people who run it, the bureaucrats, I'm told they could, if they wanted, cause the earth to stop turning on its axis. That's a challenge the Indian military has to deal with. But that said, it's a good military. It could use some improvement, but it's the big player in the Indian Ocean. And it's important not just to look at the Pacific, but also consider the Indian Ocean. And the Chinese are well aware of that. So India is it's an ally, it's a friend at least. And the more that we can work with them, the better. But we can also have other countries, particularly the Japanese, who have a very good relationship with the Indians, better than ours, I would suggest, piggyback on them or get the Indians involved. Deal with the Indians properly and treat them sort of the right way. And we can get a lot, awful lot of cooperation from them and vice versa. So that's, it's nice to see them, as I say, just change from years ago when they were non-aligned and even Soviet-aligned. So that's something that's, I think, a positive development, but it does need some effort and some patience to deal with the Indians.
Let me ask you just two sort of related questions, if I can, quickly before we run out of time here, Grant Newsham. One is, you've spent time, as we've been discussing, in the electronics industry. One of the things that the Chinese are clearly doing is using this essentially state-owned entity, certainly People's Liberation Army-tied entity, Huawei, telecommunications conglomerate, to try to fracture the Western alliance by getting countries that are part of it to hook up with the 5G networks that the folks at Huawei are building for the Chinese. That's point one. Point two is, you've mentioned, and I couldn't agree with you more, we need to be there in the region. The numbers of assets that we have deployed are scarcely enough to have much of a presence, let alone a really permanent one. And this is in contrast, of course, to the permanent presence that the Chinese have been establishing, notably in places like the South China Sea with their now fortified islands. Talk about both of those, if you would, as to what we need to be doing to remedy those situations, if we can.
Okay, well, regarding Huawei, it's as bad as charged. You know, I remember hearing, being told of this well over a decade ago. And not just from a security standpoint, it's like a company out of a James Bond movie and the villains. But the pressure that is being put on it is a good thing, and we should do everything possible to challenge this. And this administration deserves credit for going after it. They need to stick with it and really keep the heat on. In terms of our presence, the Chinese are building ships a lot faster than us, aircraft as well. The quality is very good, and we can barely build ships that certainly not in the numbers. And considering that we call the littoral combat ship a warship and count that in our numbers, it's unfortunate. Our defense industry is at some point going to have to wake up and get their snouts out of the trough. We build stuff for it costs too much. We don't have the money for this sort of thing, and it doesn't work as well as it should. Just look at the naval shipbuilding record, and it's atrocious. So somehow, as I say, our defense industry is going to have to sort of wise up and actually start performing better.
To what extent is that a function of, you know, the red tape, the bureaucratic inertia, as well as the sort of risk-averse practices of the bureaucracy, as well as quality control problems within the industry itself?
Well, defense contractors will tell you it's the government's fault. The government will tell you it's the defense industry's fault. Sometimes there's somewhere in between, but my sense is that at least with the loss of some of the defense contractors, when you have a government that will pay almost any price for something, well, you tend to charge any price for it. You just think of the healthcare industry. And I do think that our industry, it could use a few more patriots rather than
profiteers. Yeah. We have to leave it at that. A very bracing conversation on so many scores. Grant Newsham, thank you for taking the time to go through this with us at length. And I hope you'll come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.